World War II ended in 1945, 72 years ago. President Trump was born the next year, and his campaign opponent Hillary Clinton was born a year after that. The average U.S. senator born about 1956. Representative younger than that, the population at large younger still.
So, for most American leaders and voters, there's no direct memory of the global catastrophe of World War II. And our next guests say that's an important fact and a very dangerous one. They say that the United States actively worked to avoid a global calamity for seven decades because of the memory of World War II. And without that memory, we could be headed to a new worldwide disaster.
Hal Brands and Charles Edel joins us now. Their piece in Foreign Policy is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Hal Brands is a distinguished professor of global affairs at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Hal, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Charles Edel is an associate professor of strategy and policy at the U.S. Naval War College. Charles, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks very much for hosting us.
Well, Hal, let's start right after World War II. How did the memory of World War II and what happened there shape the American-led post-war effort in the following years and decades?
So I think what happened was that after World War II, there was a concerted effort on the part of U.S. policymakers and the U.S. political class writ large to deal with the conditions that had led to the rise of global conflict in the first place. And those conditions were largely associated with nationalistic economic policies that had fostered the slide into depression during the 1930s, and then a failure to maintain effective collective security arrangements, which led to the rise of Nazi Germany and Japan as threats to global peace. And so after World War II, American policymakers basically learned the lesson of never again, that they should never again allow these things to happen. And so many of the policies that we now take for granted, the pursuit of free trade agreements that benefit everyone, U.S. participation in security alliances that really ring the globe, were responses to the tragedy of World War II and the threat that it might happen again if strong measures were not taken.
And Charles, we've seen bad things, certainly wars, some international wars happened since World War II. But can you put the scope of World War II in context compared to what happened since then?
Sure. By no means did the order that the United States helped to engineer following World War II by those lessons that Hal was talking about preclude all conflict in the international system. The point, though, that we had made in the article is that by this conscious decision of the United States to play a global role and support a different type of system, you would suppress global conflict. You would stem in the bud to a certain extent local conflicts before they metastasized, before they got out of control. You would create the conditions for American interests to flourish around the world. So over the past 72 years, as you pointed out, in no way, shape, or form did war leave the landscape of American foreign policy. In fact, America was involved with multiple wars during that time. But what you did see was the concerted effort by the United States embedding itself with like-minded allies around the globe to prevent and stop the further spiraling and escalation of conflicts into growing into a much larger conflict itself.
And Hal, that so far is the context for this piece the two of you wrote. You wrote it because you're worried that we're forgetting lessons of World War II and we're drawing back from this effort to prevent the next global catastrophe. What signs do you see that we Americans are forgetting those lessons?
Well, I think it's the lessons not just of World War II, but the lessons of international relations going back millennia. And in fact, one of the points we make in the piece is that these catastrophic breakdowns of the international order have tended to be the rule rather than the exception over the centuries. And so it's extremely naive for us to think that we have somehow gotten past the possibility of tragedy on a global scale because human nature has changed, because it most certainly hasn't. The problem is that in many ways, American foreign policy has become a victim of its own success. American foreign policy has been so successful at creating a prosperous, relatively stable global order over the past several decades, but I think many Americans have forgotten precisely why it is we do these things in the first place, precisely why it is we have these alliances, for instance. And so some of the worrying signs, I think, that we've seen in recent years are sort of representative of a growing American ennui with with globalism. And so you can certainly see this with the fact that the United States elected as its president someone who has expressed open disdain for American alliances. You can certainly see it in the fact that the U.S. defense budget has declined at the fastest rate since the Korean War over the past several years. And there are other signs as well. But we think of these kind of as the warning lights flashing on the dashboard, indicating that Americans are perhaps losing sight of why these difficult and extraordinary exertions are worth it in the first place.
Talking to Hal Brands and Charles Edel about historical memory, the risk of a new global catastrophe on the scale of World War II and many throughout history. Charles, let's focus on the cost side of things. You write in your piece that Americans are focused on the costs of the things that we've been doing to try to prevent a global catastrophe. So free trade sometimes risks economic dislocation, job loss here at home, military spending, loss of lives for American troops, maintaining global order. Make the case that it is worth those costs.
So the case has generally been made, or at least it was at the outset of this period, that it was worth paying a penny in to be penny wise or pound foolish, right? That the idea would be that you would pay forward, that you would forward deploy U.S. troops, that you would have open trade associations and arrangements in order that you wouldn't have these conflicts growing later. So you would forward stage, permanently deploy United States military forces abroad as a dampener on conflict in Europe and in Asia that would otherwise grow larger. Is it expensive? Absolutely. But the argument had been made and was made persistently that permanently stationing U.S. forces abroad in many ways was cheaper than deploying them to those various regions when conflict spiked and spiraled in the first case.
Hal, I guess a question might be, why us? In 1946, sure, we were the only ones who could afford to do something like this in the United States after the devastation of World War II. Things are different in the 21st century. Can't the United States back away from this and let other parties step up?
So this is something that Americans have been tempted to do since the outset of the post-war order. In fact, one of the statesmen that we most associate with the creation of the American world order, George Kennan, always hoped that there would come a time when the United States could pull back from the deployments and the exertions that Charles talked about and return to a more normal existence. The problem is that just because of the way that the world is configured in power and geopolitical terms, there really is no one else who can play this role. And so the fact is that the United States has proven uniquely capable of rallying other democratic nations to contain global disorder, in part because of its power, in part because of its geography makes us less threatening to countries in Europe and Asia than perhaps other countries are. And if you look around the world today and you ask yourself the question, what countries are most likely to pick up any geopolitical slack that the United States leaves if it pulls back from the scene? Unfortunately, it is unlikely to be the United Kingdom and France and Japan. It is likely to be the countries that have shown the most energy in undermining the international order over the past decade or so, so the Chinese and the Russians. And so I think that the urge to want to pull back and return to a more normal role is natural, but I think it would have devastating effects.
And Charles, in the piece, you point out that this is a difficult time on the world stage. What are the risks you see if the U.S. pulls out of its role around the world now?
I think what we had pointed to, and in fact what we see, is the lessening of American leadership, the increased concern of the United States' willingness to use its power to dampen some of those conflicts, as we've seen, points to exactly what Hal had just spoken about, namely that you have a growing sense of political power vacuums in both Europe and Asia, certainly. And with less of an ability and less certainly of a perception of U.S. willingness I think you would see opportunistic authoritarian powers on both ends of that Eurasian landmass, Russia and China, continuing to probe at the periphery and further than that, and test American power, undermine America's democratic allies in both of those regions. And I think the more that it looks like the United States will not check those revisionist powers, the more testing you are likely to see of that by both of those powers, if not others as well.
We're talking to Hal Brands and Charles Edel. In a new piece in Foreign Policy magazine, they say Americans have forgotten the experience of a major global catastrophe, something on the lines of a World War II, and they say that puts us at risk of a new international disaster.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the risk of another global catastrophe on the scale maybe of World War II? Do you think the United States should continue to play a leadership role in international affairs, even if it comes with a cost? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Charles Edel and Hal Brands. They say Americans don't remember global tragedies on the scale of World War II, and that's leading the country to give up its leadership role, putting us at risk of a new global meltdown.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think the United States should keep its leadership role in international politics, be the first to intervene, try to help maintain the world economy? Do you think the costs are too high? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Hal, you mentioned a phrase, you mentioned the phrase earlier, warning lights flashing on the dashboard. What warning lights do you see around the world that our role could be tested as we're pulling back?
Well, I think there are a handful of things. So both Russia and China are essentially authoritarian great powers that are trying to exert primacy within their own geopolitical regions and are pushing against U.S.-led alliance systems to do so, and are increasingly using outright force in the case of Russia or more subtle forms of coercion in the case of China in order to undermine U.S. alliance structures and shift in geopolitical arrangements in East Asia or in Eastern Europe. I think we are also seeing what you might think of as problem states or rogue actors that are becoming more empowered and more dangerous. And so North Korea now has a sizable nuclear arsenal and is apparently working towards an intercontinental delivery capability that could eventually bring a nuclear weapon to the United States. Iran is coming out from international sanctions as it continues to push for influence in the Middle East, and so that category of challenges is growing as well. And then beyond that, there are the challenges that we are used to seeing over the past 25 years, but in some ways have gotten worse. And so the Islamic State, for instance, its military fortunes are on the decline now, but it is shown that non-state actors, non-state extremist groups can accumulate terrifying amounts of military power and can exert a really destabilizing influence on regions that are still important to the United States. So across these issues, the common thread is that the relative stability to which we've become accustomed, certainly over the past 25 years and really over the past 70 years, seems to be eroding.
Let's go to our callers now. Rick is on the line in Sun Prairie. Rick, hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'm enjoying this conversation. I'm certainly reminded of the famous George Santana quote, "Those who can't remember the past are doomed to repeat it." And I think the authors are onto something important here, but I have a question for them in regard to one of their comments. They had mentioned that one of the most important post-World War II policies of the United States was free trade, and that certainly has worked out well with the West, or even with Japan, for that matter, in the Marshall Plan with Europe. However, they also mentioned the emergent threat from the Chinese and the Russians. Those free trade policies of the Chinese, I would argue, were ill-advised for the reasons that the authors had mentioned, the fact that they're a totalitarian military dictatorship and yet they're in the WTO, et cetera. My question to them would be, what should we have done differently in regard to the Chinese with trade policy, or what should we do going forward?
Rick, thanks for the call. Hal, do you want to take a crack at that?
Sure. I think Rick puts his finger on a very important dilemma, which is that over the past 25 years, the United States has pursued a two-pronged policy toward China. So on the one hand, we have sought to hedge against the possibility that China would behave aggressively by maintaining essentially military primacy in the Western Pacific. On the other hand, we've sought to maximize the possibility that China would become a satisfied, productive member of the international system by helping China develop its economy and integrating that economy into the broader global economy. And these were meant to be sort of the carrot and the stick. These things were supposed to go together. But what we've seen over the past decade, certainly, is that China has become much richer. It's become much more integrated into the international system, but it hasn't necessarily become more satisfied. It hasn't become more peaceful. And so now we confront the fact that these two prongs of our policy seem to be in tension with one another. I'm not sure that there was a dramatically different policy we could have pursued starting in the early 1990s. I think the one thing we might have done differently with the benefit of hindsight is to place greater conditionality upon China's entry into the international economy. And that would have taken the form of economic conditionality. So taking steps to make sure that China was not continuing to pursue mercantilist economic policies after it joined the WTO, for instance, but also political conditionality, and perhaps placing greater human rights conditionality or greater conditionality with respect to political liberalization on China's entry into the global economy. In retrospect, that might have been desirable.
Rick, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Tom with us in Eau Claire. Tom, hi. Tom, are you there? I don't think we have Tom. Tom's, in a nutshell, Tom's point, I think, was that we can't keep up this level of international spending along with all of the domestic spending needs that we have. We'll collapse if we try to juggle both of those needs. Charles, what do you think?
I think that Tom's question is a useful one because on the one hand, spending in order to keep us internationally engaged is not cheap, does not cost nothing. And as I think Tom rightly points out, our entitlement spending is not in stasis. In fact, it's rising and rising in a way that at some point is going to eclipse our other discretionary spending. However, a little historical perspective is useful here when we take a look at the discretionary military spending, for instance. On the one hand, our defense spending, when you look at it in real terms, is at and heading towards the lowest it's been in comparative terms since the beginning of World War II. This doesn't mean that we don't spend a lot. This doesn't mean that we don't spend more than the rest of the world combined, as people like to point out frequently. But this also should show us that historically, even over this past 72 years that we're talking about, we are spending almost at a historically low point as the threats seem to be proliferating and diversifying, meaning that we might want to think about where those would scale upwards. In fact, you know, the sequestration of the defense budget, which was the agreement that everyone made but that nobody liked under the Obama administration, held that we were going to indiscriminately keep defense spending at a flat line. We now have a budget moving forward for the first time in many years, but this doesn't mean that defense spending can't come up. But Tom points, I think, rightly to a major issue here that unless we are willing to grapple with some other larger economic budget items like entitlement spending, there will be a squeeze at some point on this.
Well, as we start to wrap up, Hal, I want to ask, is it inevitable that we're going to have another major international catastrophe like World Wars I and II or the 30 Years' War, or you refer to the Peloponnesian War? Is this just a cycle of history that's going to happen, or is there something we can do about it?
I don't think it's inevitable at all. In fact, I think what the past 70 years have shown is that if we pursue enlightened policies, difficult as they are, we can restrain the forces that have traditionally led to these global crackups. But the question is, will we continue to pursue the policies? And I don't think there's any inherent reason why the United States, together with its allies, cannot continue playing the constructive role today that we have played for the past 70 years. The United States and its allies still control a clear majority of global wealth and military spending. We still make up the largest combined power block in the world by a significant degree. And so ultimately, I think the issue is as much one of willpower as it is of power. It's the question of whether we are going to rouse ourselves to continue pursuing time-tested policies, or whether we are going to forget why we've done this in the first place and retreat to a policy that might be more comforting in the short term, but will probably be quite damaging over the long term.
And briefly, Charles, given the support for Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump from different viewpoints, but skepticism of free trade, skepticism of American involvement around the world, do you think that will is there in American politics?
I think the jury is out on this one. I think in many ways we've seen that the consensus, such as it was, on America's leading international role has frayed. And I think there's no doubt that the past election illuminated that for us kind of on left and right. On the other hand, American support for its international role, for its alliance system, for being internationally engaged is by no means, a minority held position. It's one that is contested and is being contested in a very public way from the White House even. But I don't think that there is a sense yet that the American people are ready to go home and return to a role that precludes American internationalism and leadership.
Thanks to both of our guests, Charles Edel from U.S. Naval War College and Hal Brands from Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. We've been talking about their piece in Foreign Policy. It's linked on the Central Time Facebook page. They wrote about the risks of a future international catastrophe and the United States' leadership role in the world. Share your thoughts and check out their piece on the Central Time Facebook page.